Every week, Hillsdale College President Larry P. Arn joins Hugh Hewitt to discuss great books, great men, and great ideas. This is the Hillsdale Dialogues, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. More episodes at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you find your audio. Also at the Hillsdale College Podcast Network, check out the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, the Hillsdale College K-12 Classical Education Podcast, the Larry P. Arn Show, and more, all at podcast.hillsdale.edu.
Morning glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt. That music means the Hillsdale Dialogue is here. My guest is Dr. Larry Arn. Some of you have been waiting for this week for a long time because we are finishing World War I today. Not really finishing because a lot of impressions have been made on all of you and me, and hopefully someday Dr. Arn will teach a course on these books. At the end of this, there's a Volume 5, Dr. Arn, which is The Forgotten War. And The Forgotten War... Why do you think he even devoted an entire volume to the Russian War? Is it because of what happened thereafter by the time he writes this?
Yeah. And, you know, he's a very curious man and he knew a lot about it. And also, this book sold very well. Why not write another one? And he wanted to tell the whole story. And so much of the story happened out there. And yet it all came to naught. Right, because the decision was reached in the West between the combatants in the First World War. The Soviet Union was destroyed and was not, I mean, Russia was destroyed and the Soviet Union founded. And so Russia was not part of the end. It was gone.
And so he says, gone forever, the empire of Peter the Great and the long dreamed of liberal Russia. If you turn, I'd love for you to read page 39. You've referred to it a few times, and I want people to understand what the Germans did to destroy Imperial Russia and to bring down the Tsar. Not a lot of people know this. In our generation, they might have watched Dr. Zhivago and seen Lenin in the compartment. Do you have that handy? On page 39, in the middle of April, the Germans took a somber decision.
In the middle of April, the Germans took a somber decision. Ludendorff, he's the German commander, refers to it with bated breath. Full allowance must be made for the desperate stakes to which the German war leaders were all already committed. By the way, that's generosity from Churchill, right?
Yes.
They were in the mood, which had opened unlimited submarine warfare with the certainty of bringing the United States into the war against them. Upon the Western Front, they had from beginning used the most terrible means of offense at their disposal. They had employed poison gas on the largest scale and invented the Flammenwerfer.
Flamethrower.
Flamethrower. Nevertheless, it was a sense of awe, with the sense of awe, that they turned upon Russia the most grisly of all weapons. That's something.
That is.
They transported Lenin in a sealed truck, like a plague bacillus, from Switzerland into Russia. He arrived in Petrograd on April 16, at St. Petersburg, who was this being in whom there resided these dire potentialities? Lenin was to Karl Marx what Omar was to Muhammad. He translated faith into acts. He devised the practical methods by which the Marxian theories could be applied in his own time. He invented the communist plan of campaign. He issued the orders. He prescribed the watchwords. He gave the signals, and he led the attack.
That's so ominous. It is absolutely, the Germans know what they're doing. They're infecting Russia with a bacillus, which is Leninism.
That's right. And they paused, right? That was, after all this, after all their slaughter, and this is worse than the flamethrower and the poison gas. This is worse than that. And it was worse than that. Killed many more people than died in the whole First World War. From all countries, they killed more people of their own citizens than died from all countries in combat in the First World War.
And that's lines on Lenin. Lenin was also vengeance. The mind of Lenin was used and driven by a will not less exceptional. The body, tough, square, and vigorous in spite of disease, was well fitted to harbor till middle age these incandescent agencies. His sympathies cold and wide as the Arctic Ocean, his hatreds tight as the hangman's noose, his purpose to save the world, his method to blow it up. And then he quotes from Oxbridge scholars saying, Lenin killed 28 bishops, 1,219 priests, 6,000 professors and teachers, 9,000 doctors, 12,950 landowners, 54,000 officers, 70,000 policemen, 193,000 workmen, 260,000 soldiers, 355,000 intellectuals. He'd basically kill everyone at Hillsdale if Lenin arrived here, and 815,000 peasants. They do not, of course, include the vast abridgment of the Russian population, which followed from famine. Lenin was the great repudiator. He repudiated everything. He repudiated God, king, countries, morals, treaty, debts, rents, interests, the laws and customs of centuries, all contracts written or implied, the whole structure, such as it is, of human society. In the end, he repudiated himself. He repudiated the communist system. What does... Hey, that's just brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah. And see, once the system was running, you know, because Lenin had the ultimate prestige of having led the revolution, and that meant while he was alive, nobody challenged him. In one way, it's a shame he died when he died, because he died not long after this repudiation, but you know, after he had killed all those people and before he could give effect to the repudiation. And so, of course, he succeeded by people in competition with one another who have committed themselves to this kind of regime. And of course, they also, their standing depends upon it. And so they went on with the killing, none so many as Stalin, who's after Mao, the greatest murderer in human history.
I'm glad you said that. After Mao. People don't know that Mao is the biggest murderer ever. And I don't know that Xi doesn't want that title as well as all the other titles that Mao had. There are three subjects in this volume, Dr. Arn. The Russian Civil War, the Irish Settlement, Turkey Alive, Greek Tragedy. And I want to make sure that we touch on each of them. You mentioned last week there was a civil war, the white Russians versus the communists. What was Churchill's view on that? What did he want to do?
His view summarized precisely is, if the Russians want a change, if they want to destroy these Bolsheviks, we should help them. And the test for that, in his mind, was would the army of Kolchak and the white Russians gain force and win? And then we could have troops, and the United States and Britain and France, and for a while Japan, had soldiers fighting in Russia against the Bolsheviks. But in Churchill's mind, that depended on the Russians taking the lead. They've been taken over by this armed force, and they have to throw it off, or else we are in the position that the Germans were in at the beginning of the First World War and later the Second World War. So we don't want to be in that position. And also, you know, unstated in the book, as far as I can remember, our people wouldn't put up with that.
Yep.
Right? That's not what we do. So
the Americans more than the Brits, and the Brits more than the French. We wanted no part of that war. Wilson didn't,
at least. That's right. But we got in it. We did some.
We had Americans, we did, up at Archangel. Yep.
And, you know, the opportunity, Churchill explains, was supplied by the fact that they made the Bolsheviks, in their early foreign policy, made some commitments to let a bunch of Czech soldiers go freely back to Czechoslovakia, it was then. And then they broke their word, and those Czechs surprised them by becoming an effective military force, and they were making havoc up there. And so the British and the French and eventually the Americans and some Japanese. And the Japanese, by the way, it's a very important thing not to forget about Japan this in contemporary times, right? Japan can be a lot of help. And they were a lot of harm in the period from about 1928 until 1945. But in this period of time, they were potentially, they were a lot of help, and they were potentially more help.
Yeah, we talked last week or 2 weeks ago about when Churchill was head of munitions, how he put everyone to work and commandeered everything. He insisted on full power when he became head of the War Office. He insisted on full power over demobilization. The generals couldn't overrule him. Right now, we need someone to have full power over resupply of our military. And some of that's going to come off the shelf from South Korea, Japan, and Singapore, and other allied nations in that region, because we can't do this all by ourselves. We can't, but we can do by ourselves, is conclude this segment of the Hillsdale Dialogue. I'll be right back with Dr. Larry Arnn as we wrap up our march through Churchill. Don't go anywhere, America. Stay tuned to the Hillsdale Dialogue, except to hillsdale.edu.
Why do Marxism and socialism continue to be so popular after spreading nothing but misery and despair for more than a century? In Hillsdale College's new free documentary course, Marxism, Socialism, and Communism, you'll learn why these ideologies are so popular and why they are inherently unjust. And you can pre-register now at hillsdale.edu/new course. In Marxism, Socialism, and Communism, a group of history, politics, and economics professors walk you through the origins of Marxist thought, its impact on the 20th century, and the dangers it poses to human flourishing. To enroll today and secure your spot in this completely free documentary course, visit hillsdale.edu/new course. N-E-W-C-O-U-R-S-E. That's hillsdale.edu/new course.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The Hillsdale Dialogue is underway. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. All of our dialogues collected at hughforhillsdale.com. Dr. Arnn, you wanted to say?
Here's a great thing. The idea just popped in my head. I got this idea from watching a podcast by Eric Prince, who's, of course, a disgraceful yes. man in the eyes of the left, a Hillsdale graduate. I don't know him very well.
Wait a minute. But I did Eric watch Prince is a Hillsdale graduate?
He is, yeah. Yeah.
Huh.
I don't know him very well, but I've always found him very sensible when he talks. And he's certainly a very brave man. He was a warrior, was a Navy yes. SEAL. Anyway, he did a podcast not long ago, and I watched it, and I really liked it. Because he and the other guy, whose name I can't remember, it's terrible, they were talking about how we would be more efficient with our military. And one of the things is, so now I will... Having led down that line of thought, the next president should ask Elon Musk to go figure out defense production. The kind of job that Churchill gave Lord Beaverbrook, kind of job that Bernard Baruch did in America in the Second World War, a big, a guy who really knows how to get a lot of stuff done. Go say, what do we need? And how do we build a lot of it at the least possible cost and buy it wherever they make it? In other words, a defense production head. I don't like the word czar. I've written articles saying we don't like the word czar in this America. We don't have czars. But somebody who's appointed by an elected official, the head elected official over defense stuff and other everything executive, go figure this out. And make a plan. And, you should work with these defense contractors. Also, you should ignore them. Yeah. I don't think Hillsdale College ever gets any money from any defense contractor. And I'm now confident that we never will.
No, you never know. Full mobilization ain't going to happen. I want to jump to the Irish settlement because we talked about Ireland before the war and how in volume one of The World Crisis, Churchill notes that Great Britain was on the brink of civil war when World War One broke out and everyone turned to and fell in and defended the country. But now World War One is over and he gives a speech to the Commons that is quoted at length at page 215 to 16 if you have the Bloomsbury edition, America. It concludes, Ulster must have British comfort and protection. Ireland must have her treaty, her election, and her constitution. He says this 100 years ago, Larry Arnn. And that settlement has held until now. The troubles were awful and bloody, but it held. And it may now evolve in a different direction. I don't know what the Irish people are going to do. But 100 years ago, Ulster must have British comfort and protection. Ireland must have her treaty, her election, and her constitution. I think you used the word prophet before. That was a prophetic speech.
Yeah, and also a major, you know, provincial things are tricky because they depend on circumstances. Churchill's father, in probably the most consequential act of his political career, joined with Neville Chamberlain's father to prevent the Gladstone Irish settlement that broke Gladstone's party. And so that's Churchill's inheritance. He was a great admirer of the of his father and of his career, thought he was following the main lines of his father's career. Churchill is a home secretary at a time when there are troubles in Ireland, and he employed the Black and Tans to put down some of those troubles and is remembered in Ireland as a vicious man because of that. I believe that charge is unjust, but never mind, it's there. And he is the one who negotiated the treaty to let them have their own constitution.
With Michael Collins, I believe. And
that's right. And Michael Collins, and he writes very charmingly about Michael Collins. He liked him. Michael Collins was apparently a heck of a guy. At one point in the negotiations, Michael Collins rose up and said, "The British government put a price on my head." And Churchill got up and brought in the wanted poster that the South African government had put on his head when he was an escaped POW. And he put it down on the table and said, "You know, we get over things like that."
That's not in the book, but that's great to know.
Yeah,
I want to talk about
it. Now, Collins said, "I'm signing my death warrant." And that proved to be true because he was assassinated.
And don't go anywhere, America. We're going to talk more about death warrants and about Churchill when we're right back. Go to hillsdale.edu for more information. Hugh for hillsdale.com for all prior Hillsdale Dialogue. Stay with us. Welcome back, America. The Hillsdale Dialogue is underway. All things Hillsdale, collected at hillsdale.edu. Go sign up for Imprimis, their newsletter. Go to hughforhillsdale.com for all of the Hillsdale Dialogues. Dr. Arne, Churchill ranges far and wide, and he does so in this concluding segment. He moves on, and I did not realize until last week when I was reading it, he deals with Armenia. Now, you know from your time in Southern California, many Armenian Americans are here after the genocide wrought upon them by the Turks. And there is a great deal of resignation when he reads about this, that beyond our reach and beyond our ability to have any ability to have any impact, the reader of these pages will be under no illusions. No power would take a mandate for Armenia. Britain, Italy, America, France looked at it and shook their heads. What's he mean by that, Dr. Arne? Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the thing, right? They just made the biggest war sacrifices in their history, and their histories are all littered with war sacrifices. And they're not going to go fix that problem. And it would take armed force. And, you know, the British fought the Turks. It's a rough rule of history that whenever Britain, Winston Churchill's nation, got into a war led by Kemal Ataturk, the head Turk, the founder of modern Turkey, Ataturk always won. And he beat them in Çanak on the coast of Turkey. And, you know, Armenia is up in the mountains to the east, you know, and between Russia and Turkey, not a great place to be an ethnic minority. And they were slaughtered greatly. But the Allied powers didn't go help with that.
And that's prudential.
So that
I know that some of our Armenian American friends will say, no, that was foolish. They ought to have done it. But there are limits to a great power's power. And that's what Churchill grows reflective at the end of this volume. I will put this on the table for you to comment on. It's pages 310 and 11. Thus, twice in two successive centuries, England was not left in the worst possible situation. Such mysterious rhythms of history will dim to the eyes of future generations The Hazards and Drama of the Punic Wars. I have read that again and again. I still don't know what he means by that. But then he goes on to say, the story of the human race is war. It was not until the dawn of the 20th century of the Christian era that war really began to enter into its kingdom as the potential destroyer of the human race. You've referred a lot of times over the course of the Hillsdale Dialogue to the essay that he wrote about the mechanization of war and its potential to destroy everything. But what does he mean by the hazards and drama of the Punic Wars, that we won't understand World War I? Is it just that time will pass and the world will forget?
Well, what was the result of the Punic Wars?
Well, Rome became an empire.
What was the result for Carthage?
there is no Carthage. Yeah. If people don't know what we're talking about, if you've seen the movie Patton, there's a famous scene, I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, where Patton has a soldier drive him out to the ruins of Carthage, because after the Romans beat them, they plowed, Scipio, what, plowed the fields and sowed salt in them?
Yeah, and, you know, killed or enslaved everybody. But, you know, you got to think what the Carthaginians, see, the war, Punic Wars, start with Carthage, a great trading power. You know, they're Phoenicians, really, and that's Tyre and Sidon in the Bible, in the New Testament. Woe to you, Tyre and Sidon, says Jesus at one point. And they establish this place in North Africa, and it becomes a great trading thing, and they're really good at the sea. And they start coming into conflict with the Romans. And then next thing you know, they're fighting, and the Romans are not great at the sea at the beginning, and then they have naval battles, and they win, the Carthaginians win the early ones, and then the Romans start winning them. And then the next thing you know, they have land battles. They get closer to each other. Finally, Hannibal puts an army into Italy and comes over the Alps with elephants, and he destroys, to a person, basically, two armies, Roman armies of tens of thousands.
Yeah, every single person dead. There might have been one, I think, the Battle of Cannae, isn't it? Cannae?
Yeah, that's the first one. And they, the way the battle went, the Romans, their tactics and strategy in the war were, Hannibal exploited them brilliantly, and the Romans collapsed on themselves, and they were in each other's way. So only the outer fringe could fight the Carthaginians, and they were hugely outnumbered and killed, and they just ate their way into the middle. And Rome immediately built another army, and he destroyed that too, and they immediately built a third army. And while he's in Italy, now remember, that's the worst defeats the Romans ever suffered. And this all goes on for a long time. And the growth of Rome is Rome getting into conflict with its neighbors and beating the neighbors, and then the next bunch of neighbors, they get into a conflict. The Roman Empire was not planned. They just kept fighting until they had all of Italy, and then they ran into Carthage, and then they kept fighting, and the next thing you know, they got most of the known world empire.
So, unpack for me Carthage, what he means. It might be the key for me to understand, now that you've told people what the Punic War is. He refers to the fact that Pitt and successive Englishmen beat Napoleon over the Napoleonic Revolutionary Wars run from 1792 until 1815. And Britain is stretched to the max. Heck, they're fighting us at that time. There's the War of 1812. And they go to the max and they win that. And they beat us, basically. We accept a peace. We negotiate the United States. And then they come back and they win World War I. So he writes, thus twice in two successive centuries, England was not left in the worst possible situation. Such mysterious rhythms of history will dim to the eyes of future generations the hazard and drama of the Punic Wars. I really have no idea what he means, Dr. Arndt.
He means our wars with Britain did not result in the destruction of London or major American cities or the depopulation of either country. And that's remarkable that it didn't. And, you know, look at the hazards of the Russian Revolution are like the hazards of the Punic Wars for Carthage, because although Russia was not depopulated, its body count was extremely high as a percentage of a modern population, which are much larger, right? And so the hazards of the Punic War were the utter destruction of Carthage after very heavy loss and decades of fighting on behalf of the Romans. So, and then the British, the American Revolutionary War, and you know, the American Revolution really starts in the year 1763 after yes. Britain beat France in a big battle that we were in too. And then Britain got the idea after that year that they would be more involved in the government and get more money out of the colonies. And that when they started that, right after that war, the tensions start to build. And they culminate in 1776 with the Declaration of Independence. They culminate in 1783 with the signing of the treaty that made us a free country, an independent country. And they culminate with the War of 1812, because relations were bad between Britain and America from 1763 until 1812. And yet neither ever formed the intentions.
Right?
Yeah, 1815. Neither country ever formed the intention of killing everybody in the other country. And Churchill is saying that disguises the consequences to which war could lead.
That actually now makes sense. That's what the dialectic is. Let's close. This book is being written in 1922, this line. Certainly, 1926 instead. Certainly, the story ended in 1922 in universal gloom. Skip, skip. The task is not done. Skip, skip. Old antagonisms are sleeping. Boy, was he a prophet.
Oh, yeah. And it's not... and you know, today, by the way, just look at the world, right? There's just huge causes of war festering everywhere. And relatively speaking, we are weak, right? We're weak in armaments. We're weak in the functioning of our government. And there may be, and some of these festerings are coming because we are weak. You know, we have lost the art of sudden, quick, and decisive intervention, which, by the way, that kind of intervention, like we set out to make democracy throughout the Middle East. That's a little bit like the
going to Armenia.
The German.
Yeah, more on Armenia when we come back. Hold it right there, Dr. Arne. I'll be right back. The rest of the series on Churchill. And we have been at this for a year because of the World Crisis, which is right behind me if you're watching on the Salem News Channel. World Crisis, big book, five volumes if you include the appendices. And we're done. Next week we're moving on to Plato with brand new stuff. So don't go anywhere except over to HughForHillsdale.com so you can listen. If you've been attracted, you're a new audience, you're a new affiliate. Boy, I wish I knew all about the World Crisis and heard all those earlier Hillsdale dialect. They're all there. They're at HughForHillsdale.com.
Why do Marxism and socialism continue to be so popular after spreading nothing but misery and despair for more than a century? In Hillsdale College's new free documentary course, Marxism, Socialism, and Communism, you'll learn why these ideologies are so popular and why they are inherently unjust. And you can pre-register now at hillsdale.edu/newcourse. In Marxism, Socialism, and Communism, a group of history, politics, and economics professors walk you through the origins of Marxist thought, its impact on the 20th century, and the dangers it poses to human flourishing. To enroll today and secure your spot in this completely free documentary course, visit hillsdale.edu/newcourse. NEWCOURSE. That's hillsdale.edu/newcourse.
Welcome back to the Hillsdale Dialogue, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. All the previous dialogues about Churchill's World Crisis are collected at hughforhillsdale.com. When we went to break, we were talking about mandates. Mandates. What in the world is a mandate? It's something that the League of Nations gave to someone or some country to go and govern in the aftermath of the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, which lost World War One. We call it Turkey today, but it was the Ottoman Empire back then. It was big. It was everywhere.
It's like Great Britain and the Allies deciding to take the mandate for Armenia.
Yeah, and or like Germany thinking in 1914 and again in 1939 that they could rule all of Europe according to their likes and dislikes. Everybody else would be a subservient state, right? And that's a bigger ambition than is sensible, right? And their very effective pursuit of that ambition led to their great destruction and the destruction of much of the institutions of Europe.
And that's why I think, I hope they still teach this book at the Naval and Air Force and Army academies, because it's a great admonition to caution and against hubris. The World Crisis, that brings it to an end. Dr. Arndt, is it his greatest book in five volumes? Is it Churchill's best effort?
It's my favorite, but you know, you have to mention The Marlborough. That's a really great book, which Leo Strauss claimed is the greatest book of political history written in the 20th century. So that's,
when we're done with The Republic, we can go back to Marlborough, because I brought both volumes with me from the West Coast to the East Coast, because
eventually
you turned me on to that in 1991, and I got a very good collector. They're all marked up now, but that's a pretty magnificent book, and nobody really understands it until they know about it. We'll do that afterwards. Let's close with a word about this book. Professor O'Toole, a few weeks ago, spent time with me introducing The Republic of Plato and Alan Bloom's translation. We're going to go there next week. What do you want people to know about Alan Bloom before they begin to read his translation?
Well, he was a student of Leo Strauss, and he was a brilliant teacher, and his translation of The Republic and his introduction to The Republic are classics. And he is one of the main figures in the movement, of which my teacher, Professor Jaffa, is also part, to recover the reading of old books just to see what they say. We're going to be receptive now. We're going to understand the books as they understood themselves, is a phrase that Strauss used. And so it's an attempt to be a faithful translation by a man who had deep knowledge of it, and his introduction is also very good. So, yeah, it's
Professor O'Toole was very impressive. I think the next few weeks, 14 to 20 of them, is going to be more Arndt and O'Toole than Hewitt, but I look forward to that. Any suggestions on how people tackle The Republic other than slowly and carefully?
Yeah, you should read the introduction probably. This violates advice that Leo Strauss and Alan Bloom would read. You should just read the book. When you read the book, the book is a dialogue, that is to say, a conversation. The first thing to any great book, any book that you read, the first thing to read for is, what is it saying, right? You should, you know, it's a simple way. The first question to answer is, what does that paragraph mean? My way of, you know, like I have a copy of The Republic and The Ethics that I have written all over for long periods of time, decades, right? And I write in the margin, a lot of what I write is, what it says, what's that say, you know? Make little summaries. And don't, you know, to get a profound knowledge of this book, you're going to have to read it a lot, over and over. It's a very great book.
That's why I'm pleased. It was not planned. I am pleased we ended on a riddle and that you explained the riddle to me, because I have the Punic Wars riddle. I have a feeling we're going to do a lot of that with The Republic of Plato. That's it for this week.
We can help you. See, Dan, I don't know if you've said it, but Dan O'Toole is married to my daughter.
He did not say
it. He's my eldest worthless son-in-law. he teaches here. He's very good. I'm not in charge of his career. I've exempted myself from that. He's a bright young man. And he's
also
very
a very, very effective communicator. That was, people want more O'Toole, less Hewitt. They want more O'Toole and Arndt, but I'll still be here to hit the timing mark.
Yeah,
and that means, like, right now.
And he's the reason I thought of him, like the, you know, probably our greatest Plato scholar, and there are several, is Thomas G. West, who's, you know, old and learned and wise. Dan is also a very serious Plato scholar and very devoted to it, more devoted to it than I am. And he's young and enthusiastic. So I thought he'd be good. I think we should have Tom West in at some point, too.
We will have everyone that you want and Professor O'Toole want, because I think it's going to be not as long as World War I, the world crisis, but maybe more difficult for our audience. And we will take it slow, and we're going to have a special place for you to go to get the readings. And I'll tell you more about it next week. Don't miss the next Hillsdale Dialogue. That's it for today. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. And all of the prior dialogues on the world crisis are collected at hughforhillsdale.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hillsdale Dialogues, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. More episodes at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you find your audio. For more information about Hillsdale College, head to hillsdale.edu.